This podcast is brought to you by the Transitional Justice Institute at Ulster University. Learn more about our work, including our taught postgraduate programmes in gender, conflict, transitional justice and human rights, at www.transitionaljustice.ulster.ac.uk.
Okay, welcome back everybody to this, our fourth and final session of the workshop. I have to say, I already feel a little bereaved at the thought of this being over. It's just been, discussions have been so rich, and I feel like we're just getting started. But I know this has certainly affirmed for us all just the wealth of energy and enthusiasm and the importance of this discussion. So it falls to me to share this last session, our cross-cutting panel session. We did, as you can imagine, really struggled to devise a workshop that was as inclusive as we could make it within the limits of the online delivery and the limits of four panels. So for this last session, we looked at civil society activity, we looked at committee activity, we looked at what was coming up around the under the optional protocol, and have selected just a very small subset of issues where we do see activity and certainly potential around CEDAW and SOGI. And our panelists are very kindly going to speak to those issues, incredibly well placed also to speak to those issues. So just to note before I get into the cross-cutting panelists, the format for this is we'll have three contributions from our speakers. We'll then move into a Q&A. And then at 4:45, our time here, the last 15 minutes, we're going to move over to hear some concluding thoughts and comments from Marion Bethel from the CEDAW committee, who's very kindly agreed to round out our discussions today, and indeed has been an avid supporter of our workshop since she became aware of it. So with that, I will commence the introductions. We're very fortunate today to be joined by friends at Columbia Diversa. Lucia Baca is going to speak to work that they've been doing around conflict and questions of CEDAW and SOGI. And we're delighted to have you. Thank you for joining us, Lucia. After that, we'll move to Niels Erik Hansen, who's a lawyer who's been very involved in bringing asylum-related communications to the CEDAW committee under the optional protocol. And then we'll hear from Ksenia Kirichenko from ILGO World, and she's going to be talking about some of her work, including hate speech issues. So Lucia, I will invite you to kick us off. Thank you so much for taking the time, and it's lovely to be able to include you from Colombia, and I'm going to spotlight you now.
Hi, Catherine. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you to everyone who's joining us. Like Catherine said, my name is Lucia, and I work at Columbia Diversa, which is a leading LGBT rights organization based in Colombia. And sort of before I begin, I do want to acknowledge that we're currently experiencing a brutal crackdown in Colombia, on protests all across the country, especially in the city of Cali, and that this is sort of once again clear evidence of the government's failure to address the root causes of social conflicts and to respond to social discontent with anything other than the use of force. So today, that being said, I want to focus on three points, one being sort of the conflict's sort of particular and persisting impact on lesbian, bisexual, and trans women and girls, two, sort of the major CEDAW compliance concerns in relation to these rights, and then three, sort of the CEDAW committee's role as an opportunity to vindicate and uphold these rights. So speaking sort of to the first point, the committee has already recognized, right, in NGR 30, that women's experiences during wartime are not homogenous. And though LGBT women face many of the same risks as heterosexual and cisgender women, they also confront unique challenges because of their sexual orientations and gender identities. And sort of in the Colombian conflict, for example, LGBT women have been subjected to a pernicious cycle of violence, right? That often begins sort of in their homes, in their schools, in their communities, which ends up severing community and family ties and sort of pushing them out into the streets at young ages. This is especially true for trans women who sort of in the absence of or with diminished access to formal employment and formal education and formal employment and often end up being pushed into the informal sector, especially beauty work and sex work where they don't have labor protections, have precarious labor conditions, and are of course sort of subject to exploitation. The confluence of these sort of structural inequalities, which strip LGBT women of their protective environments, at, like I said, at young ages, and their visibility as sort of gender transgressors, right, of transgressors of the gender prevailing gender norms, end up exposing LGBT women, especially masculine presenting lesbian women and transgender women, to a greater risk of armed group violence. In fact, what we found and other organizations and even the state, right, the National Center for Historical Memory has found is that armed groups have actively targeted LGBT women throughout the conflict because of their sexual orientations and gender identities. And this, of course, is sort of a form of gender-based violence. It's a form of gender-based violence that takes on many forms. For example, some of the more recurring cases that we've seen is harassment of trans women at military checkpoints, especially of trans women that still have male documents, right, that haven't had the opportunity or maybe have not wanted to sort of change the gender component and their names in their identification. And also, for example, cases of corrective rape, so-called corrective rape, especially against lesbian women, cases of forced labor, threats, right? It's a whole series of violations that are end up being connected sort of by the discriminatory intent of the perpetrators. And even though people often, scholars, practitioners in the legal field believe that these attacks are isolated or random, they're very far from that. You know, they're sort of sustained practices rooted in entrenched cultural prejudices, and that actually sort of further armed groups' war objectives, right? Sort of targeting LGBT women helps armed groups enforce gender norms, gain economic advantages, dominate, instill fear, and even curry favor sort of with local communities. And that's sort of a crucial point that I want to make is that, not only this violence doesn't occur in a vacuum, right? Just as most all forms of gender-based violence. So not only is it entrenched in these sort of pre-existing cultural prejudices, but it enjoys sort of a broad social legitimacy generally, and is even instigated at times by civilians, right? Sort of take advantage of the presence of armed groups to punish or try to correct sort of the gender deviance of these women. And in many cases, these forms of violence end up sort of in the forced displacement and in the sort of disintegration of community groups. So this brings me to my second point, which is sort of some major CEDAW compliance concerns. The first being sort of the Colombian state's, the state's lack of due diligence in preventing, investigating, prosecuting, and redressing SOGI-based violence in the conflict. Historically, there has been sort of a marked lack of political will to understand and address the specific risks and needs that LGBT women face, and even less political will to hold perpetrators accountable. There are no consolidated official statistics on SOGI-based violence, for example, and no official statistics at all on SOGI-based violence in conflict. The overwhelming majority of LGBT survivors have never seen a courtroom, let alone any form of justice. And even now, where we're sort of in the throes of this political transition, that's supposed to be sort of this great opening, this great opportunity for change, we're still facing a grave risk of impunity in the Special Jurisdiction for Peace, the tribunal created to judge the crimes that occurred during the conflict with the FARC, and because they have failed to implement sort of gender-sensitive measures and practices to address and investigate gender-based crimes. And of course, barriers to accessing things like medical treatment or reparations are also quite formidable. So they remain elusive for most survivors. None of the survivors we've worked in, for example, have been able to like access justice, or very few have been able to access medical treatments. I think none actually have been able to access reparations, or nothing more than, for example, sort of like in being a monetary a reparation, right? That's sort of where it stops, and a few of them have been able to access that. The second sort of compliance concern I want to flag is sort of the government's flagrant violation of the 2016 peace agreement, and especially the gender perspective. So we can see this on two levels. sort of that are relevant for CEDAW. One is that even though the peace agreement has sort of espouses this comprehensive approach to security that tackles the root causes of conflict, since coming into office, the current administration has pursued a sort of hardline militarized security strategy that ends up fueling the violence, right? Like massacres have gone up, attacks against human rights activists have gone up. And this obviously ends up taking, again, a disproportionate toll on LGBT women. It affects their participation in peace building and transitional justice institutions. So that's on one level. And at the same time, this sort of buffet style approach, right, we implement what is convenient to our interests to the peace agreement has led to sort of a truncated piecemeal and exclusionary implementation of the gender perspective. It's as if LGBT women were not actually women, right? They're either neglected or actively erased. From the gender perspective, they're not counted, right? When the government reports on the implementation of the gender perspective, it almost never reports on the participation of LGBT women. And it doesn't even collect that information in many cases. And when we ask about that, it ends up telling us that it's not relevant or that there is no way to collect that information, and even says, oh no, that's private. So, you know, we really can't ask about that, or we don't know how to ask about that. So we just leave it that way. And, you know, this is in part because of its ties to these sort of anti-gender fundamentalist groups, which sort of shows its lack of political will to hold on and defend political gains of LGBT women against rollbacks. And sort of a final point to make there is that Colombia still does not have a national action plan on women, peace and security, which could help sort of address some of these issues. The government actually considered sort of developing one last year, but they basically sort of, they told the women's movement like a month in advance, right? They wanted to release it for the 20th anniversary of the WPS of UNSCR 1325, which meant that it really just wanted the rubber stamp of civil society, not any real input. Most of the women's movement said no, or, you know, a solid contingent said no, that they were not going to participate, and it did not end up coming out. So in the face of these challenges, the CEDAW, you know, the CEDAW committee still holds sort of an untapped but truly tremendous potential to vindicate the rights of LGBT women and girls in conflict and post-conflict settings. To date, the committee has made sort of notable progress on one, recognizing SOGI as grounds of discrimination. Two, sort of explaining its applicability to conflict and post-conflict settings and conflict being broadly defined, which is sort of a major point, and also promoting the implementation of the WPS agenda. But what we need now is sort of to put those pieces together. GR 30, for example, only mentioned sexual minorities in passing. And in its final observations to the last, Colombia's last periodic report in 2019, it issues recommendations on conflict and women in conflict, and it issues recommendations on LGBT rights issues, but it doesn't really put them together, right? There's no bridge there. It's like they run sort of in parallel. And so, you know, what we need now, the opportunity that's before us, is sort of to deepen that intersectional analysis, really ask what those differential, you know, specific needs and risks are for LGBT women and girls in conflict and post-conflict situations, and leverage its monitoring mechanisms to advance their rights, both in relation to the convention and in relation to the WPS agenda, where there's been significantly less political room to push for LGBT inclusion. And sort of some actions that it could consider, for example, are sort of including questions about the rights of LGBT women and girls in its list of issues and questions to ask states, including in relation to WPS commitments and to donor countries, right? How are donor countries prioritizing LGBT women and girls as well? Also to make sort of concrete recommendations and its concluding observations, once again, also in relation to donor countries, not just in countries in conflict and post-conflict situations. And potentially even issuing a general recommendation on the rights of LGBT women and girls in general that also addresses their rights in conflict and post-conflict settings. So it really is sort of a sterling opportunity to advance these rights. And I'm really excited that this can be part of the conversation, part of this workshop. I'll leave it at that for now, and we can sort of keep discussing in the dialogue.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Lucia. That was just so rich, documenting the importance of the importance of improved documentation around these experiences of LGBT women Making that important point about how rights are being denied right now in Colombia in terms of access to justice and reparations. Very important, I think, in raising the issue around the unimplemented aspects of the 2016 peace agreement, particularly now as we approach the fifth anniversary. And I mean, a great deal of, you know, the world looked to Colombia in 2016 for its gender perspective in its peace agreement. So important that we continue to look to see how, whether and how it's being implemented. And of course, the ongoing importance of participation and understanding women's participation in those inclusive terms, in terms of LGBT inclusion as well. And very nice, I think, to note the tremendous, to conclude by talking about opportunity and potential here, which is very much what's motivated our conversation. Just before I move to our next speaker, I do actually want to acknowledge that Badana Rana is here, the CEDAW committee member who's been just very proactive around questions of CEDAW application to conflict and post-conflict settings. So just to acknowledge and welcome you, Badana. Okay, it's now my pleasure to move to our next speaker, Niels Erik Hansen. And Niels Erik, if you're happy, I will spotlight you, and we look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you. First of all, thank you for inviting me. This is a great opportunity to share some of the experiences that we have made with work on specific cases, individual cases, on harassment and gender-specific violence. And as a lawyer, what we tend to do is to read the law and also conventions. And it's very clear that if you look into the torture convention, you have very specific provisions on the prohibition against torture, that member states are obliged to combat torture. And even if you read Article 3 of the Torture Convention, there is a specific prohibition against deportation to countries of origin if persons would be in risk of torture. So that's crystal clear from the convention itself. However, when you start to look into other conventions, it may be a little bit more blurred. The European Convention on Human Rights, Article 3, can give us some advice. And of course, the Refugee Convention, when we are talking about deportation. But if you take the text of the CEDAW, the Women's Convention, it's really, really disappointing that there are no provisions specifically on gender-specific violence and harassment. We have addressed a number of issues of discrimination against the labor market and different areas, but it's difficult to see how this convention can be used as a tool to protect women and other groups from violence and deportation. So keeping in mind that one of my professors long ago told me that it's a crime to do legal wishful thinking. We should always be very strict and tell our client exactly what is possible and what is not. From that point of view, we should simply get away with this convention, because there's no opportunity if you just read the words. However, since we have the possibility to bring individual communications to the various committees, the Committee Against Torture, the Human Rights Committee, and also the Women's Committee. Luckily, people did do some kind of wishful legal thinking by bringing cases on gender-specific violence. And the committee took on cases and developed case law, which clearly demonstrates that you will be in violation as a member state if you don't provide the necessary protection against gender-specific violence inside your country. That is a fact with regard to Colombia and Denmark and other countries, that if you accept to be a member of this convention, you also have an obligation to protect against violence. So this was the first step that the committee bravely took on this. And I really don't understand why this is not specifically in the convention. It's so obvious. And on a European level, we now have the Istanbul Convention addressing this. But for the rest of the world, I don't see why women shouldn't be protected. So bravely enough, we have this practice from the committee. On top of that, we then started to have a conversation around, again, maybe to do more legal wishful thinking in order to explore whether there would be possibilities to also include cases on deportation. This is the principle of non-refoulement. And from this principle, we can argue that the state like Denmark that has signed the convention has a duty not to deport people to areas where they will be in risk of persecution, including torture. And that is clear from the torture convention. But torture is a specific concept. Torture is, by way of example, what is going on in prisons in Syria when you are in the hands of the security personnel. And that's why we need a broader understanding of the violence that women and other groups may face. And that is why we were starting to file these complaints with the Committee on the Rights of Women. And most recently, we also started to do the same with the Committee on the Right of the Child. And actually, it goes like women and children has to some extent been under the Refugee Convention. It has been like a real refugee is a man, a political opponent, someone who has been fighting against the regime. So over the years, it has been a struggle to have women and children recognized as potential refugees. And that is why it really makes sense to use the UN conventions as they have a specific focus on these issues. So we started to bring cases, and the Danish government responded to the first cases saying, but There's no language in the convention implying that it should be possible to bring this kind of a case, and also implying that the committee and the convention did not have extraterritorial effects, meaning that Denmark could only be responsible for what happened to my client here in Denmark. They could not be responsible for what would eventually happen in the country of origin. I think one thing was critical here. We have the periodic reviews, which is also an important tool that as NGOs or lawyers, we can write reports and the government will have to respond during these periodic reviews. And with regard to Denmark, we were fortunate that Denmark had reported on FGM, circumcision of girls. And they, amongst other, reported that in Denmark, we have introduced a ban on FGM, even abroad. So it is possible to punish those who carry out FGM, even though it's outside of Denmark. If you then return to Denmark, you can get punished because the law in Denmark has extraterritorial effect. So since Denmark already recognized this and even reported about this to CEDAW and were proud of it, we used that in the arguments on our cases. And on this note, we ended up with first a couple of decisions that CEDAW established that the convention do have extraterritorial effect. And finally, we got the first decision saying that Denmark was in violation of this principle of non-refoulement with regard to a woman who was to be deported to Pakistan. So now it has been established and there has also been made a general comment on this. So we moved on and we also had the first case ever with the Committee on the Right of the Child, where the committee made that decision that the Children's Convention was violated. And that was exactly a case about FGM. A mother and a small child from Somalia was to be deported. And the committee made the decision that Denmark had violated the Children's Convention if they were to deport the child. We already have the second decision by the Children's Committee on the same issue. So Denmark has now been in violation twice on this issue. And this is just to make also a comment on the problems with implementation of human rights. There's unfortunately a difference between having a right and by the end of the day, getting the right. But as lawyers, we can now enlighten our clients about this possibility. And most importantly, in this kind of cases, we can stop the deportation by filing these complaints. The UN committee can stop the deportation to, let's say, Colombia. With my client here in Denmark, I have clients from Venezuela. And in this, on this note, it is really important for my clients that we take on these cases and file the petitions with the UN committees. And here, now that we have these experiences in front of us, we also start to realize that there's a lack of protection in the law and the conventions on LGBT issues. And again, that is strange. Why is that? But since there is this problem, and since we realized that it is possible to do some wishful legal thinking, we would now take on such cases as well and try to use these possibilities. Hopefully, it will be possible to bring LGBT cases, and hopefully we can then again broaden the protection and by the end of the day assist our clients this way around. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Niels Erik. It's so beneficial for us to hear from your practice perspective in terms of bringing these communications and legal actions at several different human rights fora, including CEDAW. So with that, we'll move to our final panelist, who has been really a wonderful, generous contributor for the last 2 days. I feel like we're now old friends, Ksenia. But Ksenia Kirichenko is joining us from ILGA World. And thank you so much. We'll look forward to hearing your contributions.
Yeah, thank you. I have a presentation and I want to share it, but the program told me that host disabled participant screen sharing. So maybe just host can allow me to. Okay. Thank you. I hope you can see it now. Can you? Okay, so my presentation is about specifically individual communications, two individual communications that have been considered by CEDAW. And I specifically want to talk about and to share with you some of my reflections with regard to hate speech and hate crimes experienced not only because of gender of survivors, but also sexual orientation. And I want to share specifically information about two cases that I was involved into. And here my position is quite interesting because, there were two decisions by CEDAW. One of them is on the case KK versus Russian Federation, and actually KK, it's me. And then the second, it's ON and DP versus Russian Federation. I was involved in coordination of this case on the national level when I was working with an LGBT group in St. Petersburg. So these two decisions, they are quite interesting because both of them are about hateful violence. In first case, it's like verbal violence. In the second case, it's physical violence. In both cases, they were about lesbophobic or homophobic type of violence. And both of them are against Russian Federation, which is well known for a clear position against LGBTI human rights. But the first case ended up with an inadmissibility decision in 2019. And the second one allowed CEDAW for the first time actually to recognize that a state party, Russia, violated the rights of lesbian women specifically, and it was done in 2020. So I just want to talk a bit more about each of these cases. And well, the pictures, KK versus Russian Federation, it's an MP who actually was the author of some derogatory words in relation to me. And here you can see him kind of participating in anti-LGBTI demonstration with a picture of, pedophile criminals. And of course, he was trying to say that all LGBTI people are pedophiles and all this rhetoric. And the second picture is actually this couple who was attacked in St. Petersburg and whose case event went to CEDAW. But before I start to talk about specifically cases, I was thinking about these how as feminist lawyers we can challenge the traditional concepts in international human rights law specifically. And of course, a lot has been written about private and public divide, for instance, and now we also have all these progressive concepts and about gender-based violence, for example. It's not considered anymore as purely a private matter. But when it comes to some other concepts, for example, deference or fourth instance doctrine, here I think that we can also ask more questions of a feminist nature, and specifically because, well, as a general rule, international reviewing bodies, including CEDAW or, for example, European Court of Human Rights, they do not go into fact finding and the application of the national law. For me, to some extent, it also mirrors this, again, public-private divide. And for example, now we do not say that, whatever is happening to usually women in the private realm of home, if it's gender-based violence, someone can intervene. And it's not just their own problem. But when it comes to international cases, for me, it's in a sense similar. So for example, what I experienced in Russia, for CEDAW, as a result, it was like, private realm of a particular state that should be dealt with the private kind of private rules of a specific state, and CEDAW would not intervene in this case. So for me, this is problematic from this point. But then we can see that actually there are some exceptions from this deference doctrine, and there are two of them that are usual for all international human rights tribunals and courts and committees. First, it's if national decision making was clearly arbitrary. The second reason is when the national decision making amounted to the denial of justice. But CEDAW has also the third specific, very interesting reason to actually to go into fact finding, and it's when national decision making was biased or based or gender-based stereotypes, which I think that at least from a theoretical perspective could really change everything that we know about women's rights, because CEDAW can open much more possibilities to review national fact finding using this specific exception from the deference doctrine. But in practice, what happened in two of three lesbian cases brought to CEDAW, and two of them, the committee actually decided that it would agree with what national courts did. And it was specifically about my case. So KK versus Russian Federation, it was a case about insults that I received from a local MP. We had an opening of a queer culture festival in St. Petersburg, and I was there as a lawyer because I wanted to ensure that we, for example, documenting violations if something will happen and so on and so forth. I was there, I was standing there, and we were also welcoming guests of the festival. And at some point, this local MP, well known for his homophobic position, arrived with some right-wing activists, and they started just to harass, insult people. And specifically, he was using, not for the first time, but he was using words that we use in Russian language to insult specifically lesbian women. And it was this word, kavadalka, in Russian. So he did this, and I decided that it's just too much, and I'm going to go to the police. I went to the police. I asked them to open an administrative case about discrimination and insults. They refused to do it, and they refused to do it because as a local MP, as a member of parliament, he had immunity, and there was no procedure to do anything with this immunity. So that was the reason why administrative procedure didn't work. The appeal was also unsuccessful. And then I also decided in parallel to go to civil proceedings. And I was asking the court to recognize the violation, discrimination, insults, also to prohibit the deputy from using this word in the future, and for a monetary compensation for moral damage. During these civil proceedings, we provided an expert linguistic opinion proving that these words, and specifically this word kovarelka, was abusive and derogatory. And in turn, the MP, who, by the way, never came to the court, it was only his representatives, they provided their own expert opinion, also kind of made by a linguist who was expert in business English language, not even Russian. And this expert said that the word "поверялка" actually had several meanings, and probably most likely the MP just invented this word spontaneously. It was not derogatory. And in any case, he was not aware of the derogatory meaning of this word. Based on this, the court refused our claims. So we were refused, and all the appeals remained unsuccessful. So that's kind of facts of the case. And then what happened then? Decision of CEDA was basically that, well, CEDA mentioned again this deference doctrine, saying that as a rule, they do not go into fact finding. National courts in Russia, they reviewed the case. Both parties were able to provide expert statements, and it was found that the word has several meanings. Therefore, CEDA decided that nothing indicated that there were any reasons to go into fact-finding or to say that there were anything wrong with, you know, national decision-making, and the communication was declared inadmissible. When I was trying to analyze and kind of reimagine the decision, I was thinking about maybe four main aspects, and one of them is just generally. I was thinking about if hate speech as a concept could be included into CEDAW. And what I did, I looked into all the list of issues and concluding observations by CEDAW, and I found out that actually CEDAW did make specific country recommendations 45 times since 2014. On hate crimes, hate speech, sorry, specifically. And in most of the cases, these recommendations were framed under Article 5A, which is about gender stereotypes specifically, and even in some cases about gender-based violence. Also, in many cases, when CEDAW was speaking about hate speech, it was not just about women, but also women who are facing intersectional forms of discrimination, for example, like Roma women, LGBTI women, and so on and so forth. Meaning that the concept of hate speech as it is being developed by CEDA is already intersectional. And then also from these recommendations, country-specific recommendations, I was trying to kind of identify specific state obligations that could be attached to state parties with regard to hate speech, and specifically it included to prevent and publicly condemn hate speech against women, but also to criminalize hate speech and not to consider it under misdemeanor law specifically. So that's what was happening around country periodic reviews and CEDAW and hate speech. Then, when it comes to KKS versus Russian Federation, I think that CEDAW failed to consider several important aspects, and one of them is about equality and access to justice. First of all, because CEDAW never said actually anything about the fact that I wasn't able to open an administrative case. In administrative law, it would be a public law, meaning that it would not be me myself to, you know, collecting all the evidences and proving what happened there, but it would be state representatives. So administrative procedure was not available at all, specifically because he was a deputy, and it was not commented by CEDAW at all. Then also, because I was able only to go into civil proceedings, all the burden of proof was on me. And we were trying to provide several types of documents and also evidence. And specifically, we came up with this linguistic expertise kind of. Also, we provided witnesses. We had a video recording. We even had a statement from my therapist who actually said that this incident had impacted my mental health to some extent. This MP only provided one statement, expert statement by an expert in the field of business English, never came to the court. And for me, like, it was definitely not about exactly equality and access to justice. Then the third thing is about contextual analysis, because I think that, well, it's not only generally when we speak about hate speech and all the jurisprudence around hate speech, including international jurisprudence, requires to analyze the context, because words, they can have different meanings indeed, but we need to go into the context. And here, what we had an MP who was openly anti-LGBT. And I mentioned this specifically in my application, in my complaint to CEDAW, and it was directly stated that this MP was author of anti-propaganda legislation. He was not just a random person. He went to an LGBTI event and he was using the words the exact words that he used to use and that he used even after this event. So it's not the only just randomly invented word. But also what is interesting in terms of contextual analysis of this case is that, situating subjects, he was an MP, he was a man, he was also openly Orthodox Christian, definitely he had much power than me. And in this expert statements, they even said that, the dialogue was between a man who, the dialogue was between a man who, as they said, was of a quite high social status, well-known public figure, well-educated, of a middle age, and the woman, meaning me, also educated by below the man's social status and looking clearly younger than him. So this is already about saying a lot, I think, about how they perceived this situation. The fourth, and it's the last part which I would like to mention here, is it's about translation. So I was thinking if the decision would be different if it was not the Russian language but English. And for me, English is the second language. And I was trying with my partner, who is an American and whose first language is American English, we were trying to find a similar equivalent in English, something that would characterize specifically lesbian women. And what she suggested to me to use these two words that you can see. And in Cambridge Dictionary, you can say that when you say these two words together, they can mean, in theory, just a person who doesn't want to move because, like, it's, expression related to wood or a wall built. And that's basically what happened in the court, because the statement by their expert was saying that this word was invented by the MP. And it was probably because of my slowness in the situation when I was being in a crowd and staying on the deputy's way, and he tried to get around me. So it's quite, for me, it was quite obvious that this is just something lost in translation, but then also translation from Russian into Russian. Because these words that he was using, they're not just derogatory for LGBTI, but they have very specific cultural connotations. And we also explained this in our communication to CEDAW, and these words, they are about particular criminal or criminal subculture that was created during Soviet times in some of the Soviet republics, including Russia. And when he was using these words, not in the context of prison, obviously, it was also about showing to us that we are not, we are not equal members of the society. We are like criminals, and also criminalization for LGBTI people is a very specific thing because of the history of criminalization, right? All this was not taken into account by national courts, but also by CEDAW. And the last part here, which was important for me, is that the first instance judge, she was a woman. And during the hearing, she told us that as a woman, she doesn't know this word, and it would not be derogatory for her if she would hear this. But also for me, it's about who hears these words and who could be wounded by words. Because for an ordinary woman, probably this word doesn't have all these connotations. And of course, as an ordinary woman, she could even, she has a privilege not to know about this word. We know these words because we systemically are oppressed, discriminated against, and because we were called with these words sometimes, sometimes since very young ages. And the deputy, he also was aware about this work, but specifically because he was living and building his career in a very specific situation when he was openly anti-LGBTI. So we both were in this discourse. And for ordinary, let's say, people, or for maybe even this judge, it was not obvious that it's not just the random war, but it's actually just one part of the system. When we know that this is all interconnected, we know that this was the MP who introduced the, by the way, criticized by CEDAW anti-propaganda legislation. We know that this person was constantly attempting to, you know, to, for example, to justify homophobic crimes and so on and so forth. But for a judge, probably it was just an isolated incident. And from all this, so my conclusions with regard to KK versus Russian Federation, I think that CEDAW actually had all the opportunities to at least consider this communication admissible and maybe even to find a violation. And they could actually go into, could have done this exercise by saying that the decision by national authorities was clearly arbitrary because the context was completely taken out of the consideration, because it was amounted to denial of justice, because no administrative proceeding was available because of the immunity of the deputy, and also because it was based on harmful gender stereotypes, among which are first that it's just a private matter, and specifically verbal violence is a private matter. Therefore, we don't have criminal or administrative proceeding, which just go into civil court. And then second is that there is no systemic discrimination against lesbian women in Russia, because that basically the meaning of this decision when we say that it's just like an isolated incident of just one word, which has different meanings. The third stereotype was also about like respectable men who would not use such words. And actually that was one of the arguments in their, in the MP's expert statement. They were saying that he, as a respectable man, as this like high social class man, he would never know this criminal meaning, specific meanings, jargon of these words. And finally, it's like, who is a trustworthy subject, and do we want actually to believe a woman? And probably in this case, no. And I think that it was clear that this decision and what the national authorities in Russia, what they did, was based on gender stereotypes. And therefore, I think, and I claim that CEDAW could have made a different decision, but well, that's what we had there. And then I also have some slides about the other decision, but I don't think if I have time. No, okay. But maybe I just can say that there was also another decision about hate crimes, where actually CEDAW for the first time recognized that there was a violation specifically in relation to the lack of effective investigation into an incident of physical violence against a lesbian couple, and specifically because the hatred, lesbophobic motive of the violence was not taken into account. So that's kind of positive decision, an example of positive decision that could also influence the future jurisprudence and development of the jurisprudence of CEDAW. That's all from my side.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Ksenia. I have to say, I really hope my students were tuning in for that, because it was a masterclass in terms of a gender analysis and critique of human rights fact-finding, really, and a really valuable contribution. And I think, again, one of those contributions that it probably made us all reflect a little bit on how tough it must be to be a CEDAW committee member. It's not an easy task. So with that, that's the end of our formal contributions. At this point, I really want to open up to the audience. It would be wonderful to have some contributions from the other workshop participants. I know I have, whilst you're gathering your thoughts, I'm just going to encourage you to raise your hand and ask a question. We've one from Megan, and I also have one in the chat that I'm going to share. So maybe I'll let me see, Megan, is your question for Niels Eric?
Yes, it is.
Great. Okay, so let's. I have a question for Lucia from the
from the chat function. So maybe we'll just, I'll ask this and then we'll go to you, Megan, and then we'll go back to the panelists. Lucia, there's quite a specific question here just about the HEP, the Special Jurisdiction for Peace. This is from my PhD student, Anna Martin. So recently the Colombian, the Special Jurisdiction for Peace declared its jurisdiction over gender-based persecution, including violations against LGBT persons. This is groundbreaking in international law. The HEP also noted that it would adopt an intersectional approach to examine these violations. Could you give us your views? In particular, how do you think the work of the HEP could impact the recognition of SOGI rights in Colombia? And I'm just going to add, if you want to say anything you think maybe the CEDAW committee might usefully do around that, that would be helpful too. So we'll come to you in just a moment. I'm now going to invite Megan to ask her question.
Yeah, I have actually a question for Ksenia and for Niles Eric. Okay. So Niles Eric, I really loved your presentation thinking about non-refoulement in CEDAW because it's not in the text and how we kind of push that the text forward. And thinking about non-refoulement and gender-based violence, I'm wondering if what you think about how the committee or even just how the concept of gender-based violence needs to be adapted to think about the specific forms of gender-based violence in that lesbian, bisexual, trans, queer, non-gender-conforming women experience. How do we understand their fear of returning to, as Mel and the panel mentioned, that a hostile environment, and does that reach a level of violence serious enough to prevent a state from deporting someone back to a different country? And for Ksenia, I really liked your presentation about how we need to understand hate speech within its context. And this is probably more of an observation than a question, like a true academic, but we can see in the UK, particularly with, as Alex was mentioning earlier, kind of the weaponization of gender equality to exclude trans women, and even how language that might seem benign, like this space is for real women, or it will actually be a kind of a way to exclude others. And so I just thought, what are your thoughts on how, is that hate speech? Is that just discriminatory speech? Does that distinction matter? And does it matter in the context of CEDAW? Those are my questions.
Okay.
And thank you all three. Great presentations. Really enjoyed them.
So wonderful. I think with that, I'll go back to you just in the order of the of your presentation. So I'll start with Lucia, if you'd like to.
Yeah, thanks. So I'd start by saying, so CEDAW itself, like in GR30, actually recognized that, you know, the transitional justice or, you know, that peace agreements offer this opportunity for real change, right, to advance women's rights. And that's, you know, like you said, sorry, I didn't see the question, Anna, like you said, Anna, right, this is sort of a historic opportunity to advance LGBT rights in Colombia. You know, we were actually arguing before the special jurisdiction that the crimes committed against LGBT people amount to gender-based persecution and that it should be recognized as a crime against humanity. Atright, for example, has also argued something similar before the ICC in the case of Iraq, where there, you know, there's also persecution by Daesh against LGBT people. As well as against women. If this is wrecking, right, and because we are at a tribunal that is specifically charged with looking at these crimes right now, this is truly an unparalleled opportunity. And it's an opportunity to also sort of overcome the historic debt with LGBT victims who, like I said earlier, just have not found justice in the ordinary justice system, did not find justice in the peace and justice trials, which was the transitional justice scheme before the current one, right, with the 2016 peace agreement. That being said, the HEP is not currently taking advantage of this opportunity as it should be. It is not living up to the historical moment. And there are many reasons for this, but I'll just like give three really quickly and which are, you know, very relevant for CEDAW. One is that the current structure of the HEP doesn't allow them to actually see the full extent, the gravity, the systematicity of gender-based violence, of sexual violence, of persecution of LGBT people in the conflict. Because the way the cases are structured is that they're either focused on one specific violation. For example, K001 is on kidnappings by FARC. Or they're focused on specific regions. For example, K002 is on three municipalities in a department in the Pacific Southwest of the country, right? Conflict affected regions. None of those cases are currently focused solely on gender-based crimes. And while in theory, it would be great if they could mainstream that right across all the cases, that just is not happening. In fact, what ends up happening is that the cases ended up being sort of parceled out into the different cases, and they end up being studied either in relation to other violations or in relation to specific territories. And because of a lack of funding, a lack of expertise, a lack of prioritization, it just isn't working, right? So we need a specific case on this to actually actually understand what role this violence played in the conflict and get justice for victims and survivors. It's also pursuing very narrow and patriarchal legal interpretations of legal concepts, for example, like conflict-related sexual violence, which is, for example, sort of a key point for CEDAW too, it's just to think about sexual violence more broadly. And this even goes against sort of like established legal standards in Colombia and internationally. And it's definitely an issue, sort of like Ksenia was pointing out earlier, of the private-public divide, right? They're still sort of reproducing the stereotype that many of these cases of sexual violence occur in the private sphere. And so they are opportunistic cases of violence and they're not connected to the armed conflict. And so don't end up looking at them. Similar things have happened with concepts like systematic violations, right? Which is crucial to understanding, to judging crimes against humanity. It's always based, or it's been based in recent decisions, on sort of a quantitative criteria. And what we've been trying to say to them is, if you don't look at this from a gendered lens, you're not going to be able to judge these crimes or to investigate them seriously, because you're not going to get the same number of violations against LGBT people as you are of forced displacements in the country, right? There may not be thousands of these cases that like reach the jurisdiction, but that makes sense because each of these individual violations has a ripple effect, right? That sort of impacts all other LGBT people, all other people that can identify with the survivor, and that causes them to leave that town, causes them to hide their sexual orientations, to hide their true gender identities. And so you can't really think about it in the same way. They're not doing that. And they also don't have gender-sensitive lines of questioning. And you know, they'll ask sort of like convoluted or inaccessible questions, and they'll ask one question, which is, they'll ask, for example, like a former combatant, did you guys discriminate LGBT people? And like the guy will just sit there and say, no, of course not. And then they'll move on. Right. And so whereas with other violations, they'll sort of like dig a little bit deeper and sort of push past a little bit of that initial sort of denial of the violence, here they just end up sitting with that denial. And so, you know, these are things that, you know, CEDAW has addressed for even in the general recommendation 30, right? There needs to be gender sensitive practices for investigating these crimes. And if there isn't, we just end up having more impunity. And it would be great, for example, if there could be sort of like more monitoring, right? In the next cycle, you know, when for Colombia's next periodic report about what the HEP is doing. And how it's actually investigating these crimes, whether it's living up to national, international legal standards, whether it's actually applying its gender sensitive mandate. So I think that's vital.
Fantastic, thank you so much, Lucia. Niels Eric, I'm gonna move to you. You had a very specific question there from Megan Campbell.
I would like to try to share the screen.
Okay, but you should be able to do that.
This would be my homepage for all the cases against Denmark that we have filed over the years. And if you go into, let's say, the cases on the torture committee, you will find a number of cases which have been filed with regard to people who have been subjected to torture before leaving their countries of origin, or after they have left, they have reasons to fear coming back. And what is the problem here would be that most cases would relate to torture coming from states themselves, like Iran, Syria, and so forth. Now, if we move on to gender, that would be cases that we have filed on behalf of, again, victims who have been already subjected to gender-specific violence in the country of origin, or now they fear returning to a country. But here we have cases regarding this kind of abuse that happens in the private sphere, mainly. These are sometimes related to authorities, but the case I mentioned before as the first case where there was a violation with regard to the principle of non-refoulement. This was my client from Pakistan. She had violated social norms, and then she was burned all over her her body. But this happened in the private sphere. So when she applied for asylum in Denmark, the Danish refugee board turned her case down, saying, but she was not persecuted by the authorities of Pakistan. This was a private matter. And then we filed the case with CEDAW, and by the end of the day, the CEDAW found a violation of the Women's Convention. And that is exactly what we need, that the kind of issues I already mentioned FGM, circumcision, and here we can move on, as I mentioned, the Children's Convention, which also includes women and their baby girls, so that we are broadening the scope of protection with regard to the kind of violations that would be covered by the Women's Convention and the Children's Convention compared to what is covered by the Torture Convention. And that is also why we should try to use these opportunities to broaden the concept with regard to hate speech, hate crimes that was just mentioned from Russia. And I fully agree that this kind of violations is not only about the specific victim, it's something that will influence LGBT people as such. When they see a violent attack, if they see hate speech, hate crimes against one member of that community, it will affect everybody. And that's why it needs to be a specific crime by the legislation of the country. And if there is no such legislation, then we should try to bring these cases to the international level. Thank you.
So maybe before I just go into the hate speech, I just wanted to quickly mention that there was an interesting case, AB versus Finland by the Committee on the Rights of the Child, about non-refoulement and specifically a lesbian couple with a child from Russia. And it was a positive decision at then. So I think that maybe CEDAW can actually also, adopt some approaches by other committees in this field. Because for us, when we went to CEDAW, for us it was important because we can in Russia we can choose between the European Court of Human Rights and CEDAW, and for us it was important to go specifically into CEDAW because you see CEDAW as specifically like women's rights mechanisms mostly consisted of women, mostly consisted of feminists. And therefore, for us, it was important not just to receive some analysis, legal analysis of the case, but also to receive this intersectional feminist analysis. And also, I mentioned this deference doctrine and so on and so forth. And I think that it can also be developed with refugee cases, because, for example, there was a case, AS versus Denmark, actually led by Niels, about a lesbian refugee who was asylum seeker who was refused refugee status in Denmark. And I think that also CEDAW decided that national authorities made everything perfectly and there was no stereotypes, but I think that with deeper analysis, maybe some stereotypes could be revealed, including, for example, compulsory heterosexuality, meaning that when a woman has to prove that she is a lesbian, we don't have to prove that we are heterosexual, right? And what we have to prove that we are not heterosexual, there is something about already some presumptions that could be challenged. And I think that if attorneys or activists, if they want to have more positive decisions, maybe it would be great also to think about stereotypes and naming stereotypes in the national decision-making. So also to help CEDAW to develop jurisprudence. So now when it comes to hate speech, discriminatory speech, and let's say anti-trans rhetoric or real women rhetoric, it's a very good question. I don't have a direct simple answer on this, but I was thinking about it maybe from more from my activist perspective, because, for example, we had a public consultation with Victor Madrigal, who is the independent expert on SOGIE recently. And it was a public consultation. There were several activists, including trans activists, participating there. And one anti-trans, but kind of lesbian group also arrived, and they started just to post on chats things related like these so-called trans people and, you know, all this, you know, this rhetoric, obviously. And I was trying to say something about hate speech particularly, because I think that especially it's all contextual, but when we have a space that's expected to be a safe space, at least for LGBTI people and for trans people specifically, when they come there expecting to be safe, and what they actually see is all this anti-trans rhetoric, I think that this could be considered as at least discriminatory speech, but also maybe hate speech. Then I do think that we should have some discussions about this, because I can see some rational, of course, when, for example, cis women say that they do not feel safe in certain spaces. And of course, that's because of the previous experience of gender-based violence. And of course, this should be probably somehow discussed. But I think that it's also, again, from a more activist perspective, these discussions should be also framed as a discussion that will be involving these topics, so that like trans people who already have experience of being excluded and discriminated against and so on and so forth, not recognized, so that they know what they can face there. So for me, it's some of the ideas that I was trying to come up with more as an activist rather than legal researcher, I think.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Ksenia. That was such a thoughtful contribution. We are just arriving at the end of the session. We have sort of three more minutes on my clock. I do just want to really encourage anyone, particularly anyone who hasn't spoken yet, if they would just like to come in on any of the themes. Sandra has her hand up. Yeah, please go ahead, Sandra.
Hi, just really quick to kind of... I would just like to say that I feel that anti-trans rhetoric is hate speech, and that seeing it in LGBTQI positive spaces is really disappointing. And just to say, I'm not even sure where I was going with that with the point, but just to say that, you know, it to anything that denies the womanhood of trans women, anything that denies the gender identity, the validity of the gender identity of trans people, is a direct attack on their humanity, on their citizenship, on their social citizenship. And it is just, it's unacceptable to see. So just to point that out. The other thing I wanted to say is that we just, this kind of came back a little bit to something that was brought up earlier about reproductive justice, is that a lot of the time when we talk about, women's rights and women's issues, and that there's an awful lot of cis normativity involved. So what I mean by that is the assumption that, women, that we talk about are cis women, or that we're only talking about cis women's issues. So, Alexa mentioned earlier in her answer to one of the questions, she's talking about bringing trans men and non-binary people into reproductive justice discussions, but also focusing on trans healthcare as an issue that comes up in this. So I completely agree that we need to, and I think this was raised yesterday as well, but I completely agree that we need to have discussions on, women's issues and issues that are perhaps experienced by those who are affected by misogyny and those who are affected by misogyny-based exclusion and oppression and that. But at the same time, that we need to discard a certain amount of cis normativity from our point of view, and that we need to make sure that we are being trans inclusive, whether that be inclusive of people who fall within traditionally, women related issues, or people who are trans women or trans feminine, and who also need to be included when we discuss these things. So yeah, just short input on that.
Thank you so much, Sandra. A powerful and important note on which to conclude our session. Just before I formally conclude, I do want to give our panelists an opportunity, just if there's any final comments or thoughts before we move on. All right. Okay, so with that, I'll conclude that session, and thank you so much to our panelists. It's a great pleasure and great honor now to move on to our very final portion of our discussions today, which is a contribution from Marion Bethel, a CEDAW's current CEDAW committee member from Trinidad, to offer her thoughts on CEDAW's mandate and role and responsibilities and some potentialities as well in this area of CEDAW and SOGI. So Marion, I'm going to invite you to take the form.
All right, thank you. Thank you very much, Catherine. And I'm from the Bahamas, the Caribbean region, yes, the Bahamas, thank you. And I'm really pleased to be here, to be present with all of us, all of you, and to contribute to this workshop on SOGI and CEDAW. I'm expressing my own views, and I do not speak on behalf of the CEDAW committee. The entire workshop for me has been exceptionally productive, rich, informative, and entirely engaging. And I thank each and every presenter for what they've offered. You've all deepened my understanding of the significant ways in which women's enjoyment of substantive rights guaranteed under CEDAW are shaped by their sexual orientation and gender identity. I have paid particular attention to the recommendations you have made as to how the committee could better carry out its mandate in regard to the protection and advancement of the rights of LGBTI persons. More specificity is required in our recommendations for one. I agree with you. And in my view, this workshop presents exactly the kind of constructive engagement from which the committee can benefit enormously. I recognize that my statements will not do justice to the profound and thoughtful presentations, passionate views, feelings and experiences that have been communicated. I thank the organizers for conceptualizing and delivering on the objective of the workshop, namely to make a theoretical and practical contribution to the interpretation of CEDAW and the activities of the CEDAW committee, states, parties, civil society, and international organizations. So what is the guarantee of UN CEDAW for the respect, protection, and fulfillment of the human rights of women in regard to equality and non-discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity? What in effect is the promise of intersectionality as an approach to protection of sexual orientation and gender identity of women, for women under CEDAW? In practice, the committee is ever mindful of our mandate to deliver at the level of substantive equality, and therefore we pay attention to equality of opportunity, equality of access, equality of benefits, and equality of results and outcomes. Our focus on discrimination establishes that inequality is socially constructed. We recognize that CEDAW is the international human rights instrument that provides a framework to counter the limitations of formal equality, to counter inconsistencies in the application of the law, as well as to counter the social, cultural, political, and religious underpinnings that prevent women from exercising their right to equality and non-discrimination. The convention establishes the equal valuing of all women and groups as required by formal equality, and emphasizes that all women are entitled to the benefits of equality and non-discrimination. The concept of intersectionality takes us beyond the one-dimensional identity of woman, perhaps as white and middle class, as referenced by one of the panelists yesterday. Intersectionality demands that we embrace the lived realities and experiences of each and every woman, of individual complainants, of groups of women, of all women, in the spirit of inclusion and in the fact of inclusion. In practice, the committee recognizes the intersecting oppressions women face and the barriers to women's full enjoyment of their rights based on ethnicity, race, socioeconomic status, migrant status, rurality, disability, and much more. In my view, sexual orientation and gender identity must be categorically and meaningfully included at all times. In 1989, Professor Kimberly Crenshaw's imaginative and concrete metaphor of a traffic intersection illuminated the persistent and interlocking jam of discrimination in regard to African-American women based on sex, gender, and race. Since this time, intersectionality has come to express an ever-evolving traffic of human identities, human experience, human expression, and humankind, as so ably illustrated by the Special Rapporteur on SOGI, Victor Madrigal-Bortoz, and all of the presenters in this workshop. Further, the lack of consensus on this issue of sexual orientation and gender identity within the committee is open for further discussion by the CEDAW committee. At this time, we have agreed to use the words lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and intersex, or LBTI, to describe women who express their sexual orientation, gender identity, and sexual characteristics differently from prescribed hetero norms. I'm aware that the terms lesbian, bisexual, and transgender are used mostly in the global north. For example, Audre Lorde, from an African-American Caribbean, retrieved the word Zami from her ancestral home of Cariacou in the Caribbean to denote women loving women. Yesterday, we also mentioned the Hijras of Pakistan and India. It is clear, then, that various cultures have their own language to name forms of human expression and identity. And it is also clear that alternative language is being developed to be more inclusive and sensitive and to replace the binaries of female and male and woman and man. And it is incumbent upon the CEDAW committee to enter into this ever-evolving concept of language evolving and identities evolving. That said, it is my view that sexual orientation, gender identity, and gender expression are grounds for human rights abuses against women under CEDAW. As we are all aware, there is no provision directly on violence against women in CEDAW. Yet, the international normative framework on gender-based violence against women has evolved since the establishment of the CEDAW committee in 1982. And its adoption of General Recommendation Number 19 in 1992. The same evolution can and must take place in regard to sexual orientation and gender identity as a ground for non-discrimination under CEDAW. One of the questions asked yesterday concerned the significance of the role of civil society in our committee's work. Yes, we depend heavily on the reports of the NGOs. It is from them that we learn firsthand of the discrimination and violence experienced by LGBT persons who are less likely to report it or seek redress, in addition to our own understandings and our own country-specific situations. In countries where homosexuality is criminalized, even if the law does not explicitly include lesbianism, the fear of state penalties, family rejection, or community recrimination silences LGBT persons. As a result, discrimination against women on the basis of their actual or perceived sexual orientation and or gender identity is often underreported, if reported at all. And so as CEDAW committee members, we must demand that governments report on sexual orientation and gender identity issues for women under CEDAW. Government reports often make no reference at all to LGBT persons. And so we depend on the civil society organizations to bring these matters to our attention. One of the concerns that the CEDAW committee is grappling with is that the explicit inclusion of sexual orientation, gender identity, and sexuality rights might lead to a withdrawal from CEDAW or decrease reservations. Some states also perceive references to sexual orientation and gender identity as an introduction of new rights. The committee has argued effectively that it seeks to uphold new ways of addressing existing long-term violations and new interpretations of the convention's mandate and new clarifications of violence and discrimination. This is evidenced by the adoption of the GR35 on gender-based violence against women and the inquiries into access to safe abortion in Northern Ireland and female genital mutilation in Mali. With the controversial right to abortion, CEDAW found a way to navigate this as reproductive rights and health rights. And with female genital cutting, CEDAW advanced that traditional practices resulting in harm, suffering, and violence are human rights violations. In the same vein, CEDAW must find a way to uphold the rights of women in regard to their sexual orientation, gender identity, sexual autonomy, and gender expression. In summary and conclusion, I would offer the following thoughts, which are not exhaustive on this issue. It is critical for the CEDAW committee to honor and uphold the spirit of inclusion and protection for all women so that the CEDAW convention as a living document progresses and not regresses, that the committee extends more protections and not less or fewer protections. In my view, the integrity and credibility of the committee is open to question when some vulnerable groups are protected and others are not. Recognizing sexual orientation and gender identity and expression would significantly advance the promise and the implementation of CEDAW. The committee needs to challenge homophobia, transphobia in the fight for women's equality, and address sexual orientation and gender identity as grounds for human rights protection so that LGBT persons are included specifically and consistently under CEDAW. The committee, in my view, must undertake to send an unambiguous message to states parties that denying women their rights based on sexual orientation and gender identity violates the convention and prevents LGBT persons from enjoying their full rights as human beings and citizens in their countries. And finally, I thank the organizers again, whose intellectual and activist paths have made this workshop possible, the Women Human Rights Defenders on behalf of LGBT persons, and I will take all of this with me as I move forward in my work on the CEDAW committee. I have gained from this time with you, and I will use it to make a difference. And I thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Patel. We couldn't have hoped for a stronger, a warmer, more positive and appreciative note. So thank you so much. And thank you for attending all four sessions and participating so actively. We are so very grateful to you. So it falls to me to really to round out things, just to say good thank you so much to I do want to take a moment to actually just thank and acknowledge all of our panelists, if you'll bear with me. So we commenced with a keynote address from Dr. Leona Daria from the CEDAW committee. We also had a contribution from the UN independent expert, Victor Madrigal-Borloz. We heard from Danielle Roberts from Here and I, here in Belfast, where I am, and Amana Kimiri from the National Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission of Kenya. We heard from Alexa Moore earlier today from Transgender Northern Ireland, from Marissa Hutchinson from International Women's Rights Action Watch Asia Pacific, from Mel Duffy in Dublin, from Lucia Baca in Colombia, Diversa, Neil Derek Hansen, immigration lawyer, and Ksenia Kirichenko from ILGA World. And finally, then, a wonderful conclusion with Marion Bethel. Sincere thanks to all of you for your enthusiasm, for your energy, your contributions. I really feel that we've been just hugely productive in this discussion. I have a lot of excitement about what's going to come out of it and look forward to that. In addition to the formal panelists, we've had rich contributions from several participants. So thank you so much for engaging so productively, so genuinely. It's difficult to capture a workshop dynamic when you're in this virtual format, but actually I think it's we've succeeded because people have been so generous and thoughtful in their contributions. I do want to note my personal thanks to my co-organizers, Megan Campbell and Loveday Hudson. I will say that this came out of a very speculative email saying, should we do something on CEDAW and SOGI? And I got responses from both of them in about 20 minutes to say yes. And it's only with their enthusiasm and also their expertise that we've been able to pull this off. And also I do really want to acknowledge IRAW, who were just hugely helpful in accessing the committee and in facilitating those connections with the committee. So particular thanks to IRAW. And very finally, I think people will forgive me if I do just reiterate my thanks to the CEDAW committee members who have participated, who have spoken, those who have listened and engaged. We have been really overwhelmed by the level of the response from the committee. It's been well beyond our expectations. We are so grateful for that, and we hope that this will be the sign of more productive change going forward. And my very final words are, of course, about logistics. We have recorded everything. The recordings will be available very shortly. We will communicate those to you, audio and video. And we are working on a workshop report, which we also hope to produce quite quickly and will convey to you. So we'll wrap by that. So everybody stay safe, stay healthy, take care. And we hope to see you again soon. All right, take care.